Chapter 15. I won't never go back there, she repeated doggedly. No, he assented. There was a long interval of silence, during which she imagined that he was searching her face for more light on what she had revealed to him, and a flush of shame swept over her. I know the way you must feel about me, she broke out, telling you such things. But once more, as she spoke, she became aware that he was no longer listening. He came close, and caught her to him, as if he were snatching her from some imminent peril. His impetuous eyes were in hers, and she could feel the heartbeat of his heart as he held her against it. Kiss me again like last night, he said, pushing her hair back, as if to draw her whole face up into his kiss. Zaya. One afternoon toward the end of August, a group of girls sat in a room at Miss Hatchard's in a gay confusion of flags, turkey red, blue and white paper muslin, harvest sheaves and illuminated scrolls. North Dormer was preparing for its old home week. That form of sentimental decentralization was still in its early stages, and, precedents being few, and the desire to set an example contagious, the matter had become a subject of prolonged and passionate discussion under Miss Hatchard's roof. The incentive to the celebration had come rather from those who had left North Dormer than from those who had been obliged to stay there, and there was some difficulty in rousing the village to the proper state of enthusiasm. But Miss Hatchard's pale prim drawing room was the center of constant comings and goings from Hepburn, Nettleton, Springfield and even more distant cities, and whenever a visitor arrived he was led across the hall and treated to a glimpse of the group of girls deep in their pretty preparations. All the old names. All the old names. Miss Hatchard would be heard, tapping across the hall on her crutches. Argot, Salas, Fry. This is Miss Orma Fry sewing the stars on the drapery for the organ loft. Don't move, girls. And this is Miss Eli Hawes, our cleverest needlewoman. And Miss Charity Royal making our garlands of evergreen. I like the idea of it's all being homemade, don't you? We haven't had to call in any foreign talent. My young cousin Lucius Harney, the architect, you know he's up here preparing a book on colonial houses. He's taken the whole thing in hand so cleverly. But you must come and see his sketch for the stage we're going to put up in the town hall. One of the first results of the old home week agitation had, in fact, been the reappearance of Lucius Harney in the village street. He had been vaguely spoken of as being not far off, but for some weeks past no one had seen him at North Dormer, and there was a recent report of his having left Creston River, where he was said to have been staying, and gone away from the neighborhood for good. Soon after Miss Hatchard's return, however, he came back to his old quarters in her house, and began to take a leading part in the planning of the festivities. He threw himself into the idea with extraordinary good humor, and was so prodigal of sketches, and so inexhaustible in devices, that he gave an immediate impetus to the rather languid movement, and infected the whole village with his enthusiasm. Lucius has such a feeling for the past, that he has roused us all to a sense of our privileges, Miss Hatchard would say, lingering on the last word, which was a favorite one. And before leading her visitor back to the drawing room she would repeat, for the 100th time, that she supposed he thought it very bold of little North Dormer to start up, and have a home week of its own, when so many bigger places hadn't thought of it yet. But that, after all, associations counted more than the size of the population, didn't they? And of course North Dormer was so full of associations. Historic, literary here a filial sigh for Honorius, and ecclesiastical. He knew about the old pewter communion service imported from England in 1769 she supposed? And it was so important, in a wealthy materialistic age, to set the example of reverting to the old ideals, the family and the homestead, and so on. This peroration usually carried her halfway back across the hall, leaving the girls to return to their interrupted activities. The day on which Charity Royal was weaving hemlock garlands for the procession was the last before the celebration. When Miss Atcher called upon the North Dormer maidenhood to collaborate in the festal preparations, Charity had at first held aloof, but it had been made clear to her that her non-appearance might excite conjecture, and, reluctantly, she had joined the other workers. The girls, at first shy and embarrassed, and puzzled as to the exact nature of the projected commemoration, had soon become interested in the amusing details of their task, and excited by the notice they received. They would not for the world have missed their afternoons at Miss Hatcher's, and, while they cut out and sewed and draped and pasted, their tongues kept up such an accompaniment to the sewing machine that Charity's silence sheltered itself unperceived under their chatter. In spirit, she was still almost unconscious of the pleasant stir about her. Since her return to the Red House, on the evening of the day when Arnie had overtaken her on her way to the mountain, she had lived at North Dormer as if she were suspended in the void. She had come back there because Arnie, after appearing to agree to the impossibility of her doing so, had ended by persuading her that any other course would be madness. She had nothing further to fear from Mr. Royal. Of this she had declared herself sure, though she had failed to add, in his exoneration, that he had twice offered to make her his wife. Her hatred of him made it impossible, at the moment, for her to say anything that might partly excuse him in Arnie's eyes. Arnie, however, once satisfied of her security, had found plenty of reasons for urging her to return. The first, and the most unanswerable, was that she had nowhere else to go. But the one on which he laid the greatest stress was that flight would be equivalent to avowal. If, as was almost inevitable, rumors of the scandalous scene at Nettleton should reach North Dormer, how else would her disappearance be interpreted? Her guardian had publicly taken away her character, and she immediately vanished from his house. Seekers after motives could hardly fail to draw an unkind conclusion. But if she came back at once, and was seen leading her usual life, the incident was reduced to its true proportions, as the outbreak of a drunken old man furious at being surprised in disreputable company. People would say that Mr. Royal had insulted his ward to justify himself, and the sordid tale would fall into its place in the chronicle of his obscure debaucheries. Charity saw the force of the argument, but if she acquiesced, it was not so much because of that as because it was Arnie's wish. Since that evening in the deserted house, she could imagine no reason for doing or not doing anything except the fact that Arnie wished or did not wish it. All her tossing contradictory impulses were merged in a fatalistic acceptance of his will. It was not that she felt in him any ascendancy of character. There were moments already when she knew she was the stronger, but that all the rest of life had become a mere cloudy rim about the central glory of their passion. Whenever she stopped thinking about that for a moment, she felt as she sometimes did, after lying on the grass and staring up too long at the sky. Her eyes were so full of light that everything about her was a blur. Each time that Miss Hatcherd, in the course of her periodical incursions into the workroom, dropped an allusion to her young cousin, the architect, the effect was the same on Charity. The hemlock garland she was wearing fell to her knees, and she sat in a kind of trance. It was so manifestly absurd that Miss Hatcherd should talk of Arnie in that familiar possessive way, as if she had any claim on him, or knew anything about him. She, Charity Royal, was the only being on earth who really knew him from the soles of his feet to the rumpled crest of his hair, knew the shifting lights in his eyes, and the inflections of his voice, and the things he liked and disliked, and everything there was to know about him, as minutely and yet unconsciously as a child knows the walls of the room it wakes up in every morning. It was this fact, which nobody about her guessed, or would have understood, that made her life something apart and inviolable, as if nothing had any power to hurt or disturb her, as long as her secret was safe. The room in which the girl sat was the one which had been Arnie's bedroom. He had been sent upstairs. to make room for the home week workers. But the furniture had not been moved, and as Charity sat there as he had perpetually before her the vision as he had looked in on from the midnight garden. The table at which Harney had sat was the one about which the girls were gathered, and her own seat was near the bed on which as he had seen him lying. Sometimes, when the others were not looking, she bent over, as if to pick up something, and laid her cheek for a moment against the pillow. Toward sunset the girls disbanded. Their work was done, and the next morning at daylight the draperies and garlands were to be nailed up, and the illuminated scrolls put in place in the town hall. The first guests were to drive over from Hepburn in time for the midday banquet under a tent in Miss Hatchard's field, and after that the ceremonies were to begin. Miss Hatchard, pale with fatigue and excitement, thanked her young assistants, and stood in the porch, leaning on her crutches and waving a farewell as she watched them troop away down the street. Charity had slipped off among the first, but at the gate she heard Eliza calling after her, and reluctantly turned. "Will you come over now, and try on your dress?" Eli asked, looking at her with wistful admiration. "Want to be sure the sleeves don't ruck up the same as they did yesterday." Charity gazed at her with dazzled eyes. "H, it's lovely," she said, and hastened away without listening to Ally's protest. She wanted her dress to be as pretty as the other girls wanted it, in fact, to outshine the rest, since she was to take part in the exercises, but as he had no time just then to fix her mind on such matters. She sped up the street to the library, of which S. he had the key about her neck. From the passage at the back she dragged forth a bicycle, and guided it to the edge of the street. She looked about to see if any of the girls were approaching, but they had drifted away together toward the town hall, and she sprang into the saddle, and turned toward the Creston Road. There was an almost continual descent to Creston, and with her feet against the pedals she floated through the still evening air like one of the hawks as he had often watched slanting downward on motionless wings. 20 minutes from the time when as he had left Miss Hatchard's door she was turning up the wood road on which Harney had overtaken her on the day of her flight, and a few minutes afterward as he had jumped from her bicycle at the gate of the deserted house. In the gold-powdered sunset it looked more than ever like some frail shell dried and washed by many seasons, but at the back, whither Charity advanced, drawing her bicycle after her, there were signs of recent habitation. A rough door made of boards hung in the kitchen doorway, and pushing it open she entered a room furnished in primitive camping fashion. In the window was a table, also made of boards, with an earthenware jar holding a big bunch of wild asters. Two canvas chairs stood nearby, and in one corner was a mattress with a Mexican blanket over it. The room was empty, and leaning her bicycle against the house Charity clambered up the slope, and sat down on a rock under an old apple tree. The air was perfectly still, and from where she sat she would be able to hear the tinkle of a bicycle bell a long way down the road. She was always glad when she got to the little house before Harney. She liked to have time to take in every detail of its secret sweetness, the shadows of the apple trees swaying on the grass, the old walnuts rounding their domes below the road, the meadows sloping westward in the afternoon light before his first kiss blotted it all out. Everything unrelated to the hours spent in that tranquil place was as faint as the remembrance of a dream. The only reality was the wondrous unfolding of her new self, the reaching out to the light of all her contracted tendrils. As he had lived all her life among people whose sensibilities seemed to have withered for lack of use, and more wonderful, at first, than Arnie's endearments were the words that were a part of them. As he had always thought of love as something confused and furtive, and he made it as bright and open as the summer air. On the morrow of the day, when as he had shown him the way to the deserted house he had packed up, and left Creston River for Boston, but at the first station he had jumped on the train with a handbag, and scrambled up into the hills. For 2 golden rainless August weeks he had camped in the house, getting eggs and milk from the solitary farm in the valley, where no one knew him, and doing his cooking over a spirit lamp. He got up every day with the sun, took a plunge in a brown pool he knew of, and spent long hours lying in the scented hemlock woods above the house, or wandering. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.